Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to episode 29 of the A24 Project, the only podcast to take you through the incredible back catalogue of A24, two films every fortnight, along with occasional bonus interview with the people behind the movies. On this week's episode, we are looking at The Black Coat's Daughter, aka February, and Free Fire. And to guide you through, I'm Dales King, and with me as always is co-host Lee Hutchison. How are you this week?
Yeah, really good. I'm looking forward to this one.
Excellent. Well, I mean, we've been lucky enough to get a couple of lovely five-star reviews this past week on the podcast. Judge Kingpin has said, you could spend $40 on an A24 t-shirt, or you could get interviews, news, reviews, and from the A24 Project for free. Five stars. Or you could do both, because I indeed just spent about $40 on an A24 public access t-shirt. And annoyingly, of course, then the Midsummer t-shirt's getting restocked next week, and I could have saved myself the postage. That's, of course, assuming that both items would have been in stock at the same time, which is pretty much now an impossible if you ever try to buy anything from the A24 store. And the other review we've got is from Turn Up the Lights, who says, five stars for the story of A24. Looked at with analysis of their films, reviews, and interviewing those in the making. So thank you to those two for the five-star reviews. And as always, if you want to give us a five-star review, then we'll read your review out on the show. So thanks to everyone who leaves a review on iTunes. It's always great to hear your feedback, and it certainly helps with raising the profile of the podcast. And we may even do a couple of competitions in the future to encourage some reviews and give you some nice A24 prizes. So it's A24-hour news time, and the big item of news for this week, certainly for us here on the A24 Project, is the London Film Festival lineup was announced last week, and we're going to be lucky enough to be able to see A24 films The Last Black Man in San Francisco and The Lighthouse in advance, and they will screen there, and we're going to cover the screenings and hopefully maybe even try and bag an interview or two. Lee, are you excited for these?
Yeah, I'm really excited for this one. I think we've had high hopes that Lighthouse was going to come to London Film Festival. Had hoped that sort of Last Black Man in San Francisco would come too, but I think we're both very excited. And the fact that Robert Eggers is going to be there as well makes it all the more sweeter.
Yep, I think he'll be our white whale for the festival. We're going to be trying to try and get an interview with him. I was hoping for some RPATS action, given that I was running the numbers recently. And he is the most frequent male star of A24 films. He's now got four. And Elle Fanning is actually the highest grossing one for females. She's in four as well. She kind of sneaked up on me there. I wasn't expecting it. But she's steadily doing great work for A24, so we should try and get her on the show one time as well, I think. I mean, it's good that the Last Black Man in San Francisco's there. It is out at the end of October, but it's always nice to see it in a festival. But Lighthouse was the big one for us, I think, because it has now been confirmed, I think, pretty much 100%, that we're looking at for a UK release date of January 2020. So we would have had to wait another 3 months before being able to see this if we'd missed our window at the festival. So fingers crossed that we get our tickets and... of course, fingers crossed it's actually good, I suppose, as well. You know, it's getting hyped up a lot, but hopefully it'll live up to the hype. But I think as fans of The Witch, which we both are, I think we should be okay. I think it should be our type of film.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of good that we're getting it just before the American release in October as well, because, as I said a few episodes ago, this is a film that I feel could be really spoiled quite easily. And the idea of sort of getting in just before the loudmouthed Americans, perhaps, means that we'll kind of go into this and sort of see it in its best way, sort of as blind as possible. And in January, I think we would have probably had a lot of things ruined, maybe by award season, think pieces, tweets, and so on. So I think we've managed to just get this in the nick of time.
Yeah, I think this is a film, just from the trailer, I think that could become quite meme-worthy in certain A24 Hive areas of Twitter. And yeah, I think we can agree that we've already seen certain films being spoilt before release in terms of discourse and stuff like that. With, I mean, it's only been about 24 hours since Joker screened at Venice, and I'm almost already sick of all the think pieces on it already. It's like, yeah, some of us don't get to see. Sometimes I think film festivals are only there to basically wind up people going to the next set of film festivals, because a lot of these films take like months. You know, you're looking at December, January before they actually screen to the public. It's just a way to wind up film critics like ourselves, I think.
And then as soon as we're invited to the party, it's like, oh, well, who cares anymore? We're now getting to enjoy everything. And here's my discourse and reviews and everything, and you can take it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Here's my frame-by-frame analysis of Lighthouse for the entire 90 minutes of the film. Yeah, enjoy that. Yeah, no, we won't do that. No, we will. We'll do a teaser review on the show, and then we'll probably leave our... We'll do a main review on Filibuster, but we'll leave our big review until we reach it on the A24 project, as always. But the second bit of news we got this week is that the A24 Public Access series has come to an end in America. This was a series of outdoor billboard screenings of films such as Good Times, Spectacular Now, Moonlight and The Witch that were screened in the towns and cities where the films were set. Now, of course, following their announcement on Twitter that they were really happy with how it went, I tweeted them asking for, and I have documented evidence of this, asking for a screening of Under the Skin in Glasgow projected onto the side of a white transit van, and A24 replied with 10,000% yes. So I'm taking that as a legally binding contract, and hopefully we'll be able to see that soon. And of course we're available to host, aren't we, Lee? Would you host a Absolutely. Screening of that?
Yeah, and we'll have A24 Project stickers as well there to go with all their cool merch as well.
Well, there you go. And we'll try and get ScarJo along, but she might be disguised as a tree. Who knows? So, Lee...
I should add as well. Oh, sorry.
No, yeah.
I was going to say, I have some breaking news.
Oh, do you now?
Yes, someone has just slid into my DMs with some news. So, yes, I will have to keep them their name anonymous, but... obviously, Midsommar's director's cut is now kind of kicking around in America, and in the UK it's being done a bit of a short service, as it's being only shown in Picturehouse Central in London, much to my annoyance. And someone has just dropped in to tell me that the problem is the distributor does not want it to be rated by the BBFC, who are the British Board of Film Classification, who rates the films. So technically the film, even though it says 18 rated on the Picturehouse website, is going to be shown unrated. And if they tried to do it at any other cinemas around the UK, they wouldn't be able to do that. Without BBFC screenings, what's it called? Any sort of screenings without BBFC certificates have to be approved by local councils, which could be a bit of a convoluted process. So that is why we are looking at a bit of a blackout here in the UK for the Midsommar Director's Cut, is that it is technically unrated and they're only getting away with doing it in Picturehouse Central in London for that reason. So thanks to that anonymous DM that just dropped only a few minutes ago.
This is proper sort of deep throat, you know, Watergate style stuff here, somewhere from the inside. Dropping that knowledge bomb on us. I mean, I've working for in an independent cinema, and I have spent many times and many hours watching independent films that do not have distribution deals, and watching them and then basically having to provide guidance and submission ratings to the local council in order to get a basically certificate for the screening in order to go ahead with them. So I know the pain, but with something like this, you think it wouldn't, I mean, they would make their money back on the amount of money it would take them to get a BBFC. So that's quite an interesting wrinkle there. And I mean, as far as I'm aware, it's basically, it's been confirmed that the Blu-ray will not have the director's cut. So A24, do you want to help us out and chuck us a screener or something?
Now that they've tweeted you, if only they'd followed you, you could have slid into the DMs.
Oh, no, I'll find a way of sliding into A24's DMs. Interesting fact, as everyone knows, you know, this is episode 29, but we've had a few bonus interview episodes along the way, but the films we're about to discuss are actually the 47th and 48th films distributed by A24, and that actually brings us up to the halfway point of our little project. At the moment, you know, disclaimer saying there are currently 96 A24 films either released or programmed with scheduled release dates. There are a few more in the works, so obviously things will change as we go on. But at the moment, as we speak, we have reached a halfway point. And so, Lee, you know, halftime thoughts. What have you made of the project so far? And sort of what are your top films as we reach the halfway point?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I never kind of realised we'd got there kind of already. I think it's one of these ones that... Yeah, I've really enjoyed doing it, because I remembered when we sort of thought about doing it, it was like, there's so many of these films we've not seen, it'll be good to sort of cover them and we'll take it from there. And I think the films that I've liked the most have been the ones that I liked going into the project. Like, the ones that I tended not to see were sort of the ones that went sort of to direct TV, perhaps, in America. And just the quality is good, middling. But I think it's one of these ones for me, I've learned for sure that, you know, just because it has perhaps the A24 logo at the start, it's never the sign of great, incredible quality. There's films to come, for example, even at their sort of, as they continue to get bigger and more popular, that I still think are pretty ropey. I think there was quite a few one-star films sort of that we've covered so far. But for me, I think my favourite ones, I mean, I've seen 79 out of all their films today. I keep a wee letterbox list, but my top five at the moment would be Enemy, 20th Century Women, American Honey, Moonlight, and at number one, Under the Skin. So yeah, I'm really excited to go ahead and see what's still to come. And as I say, I continue to update this list after each episode. I put the two movies in there and give them a wee kind of rating. So that's been my top five. So Under the Skin has been there since episode 3, I think, since our debut kind of trilogy. So yeah, I'm really enjoying it and can't wait for more.
You know, I think I am actually pretty much exactly the same as you, actually. I've got Lock in at number 5, but then I'm Enemy, 20th Century Women, Moonlight, and Under the Skin. And 20th Century Women, yeah, as we discussed on the previous episode, was a major, not a surprise for me, because I'd heard good things, but I just had not seen it until a couple of weeks ago. And it's, yeah, it's definitely in my top 5 at the moment. Will it be there when, by the time we reach episode, you know, 95 and 96 films? We'll have to see. But no, I think it's been good. I think, like you say, yeah, it's been an interesting start to the project, and that there's a lot of films that we hadn't really heard of. Some, I think, a much bigger swing in terms of quality initially, but I think we're really hitting the golden era of A24, and I think there's going to be a lot more sort of 4 and 5 star rated films as we go along. But I guess it's up to us to find out, you know, what we make of this week's episodes. And first up, we're going to be discussing The Black Coat's Daughter, aka February, depending on where you're watching the film. And this was written and directed by Osgood Perkins and has a 73% critic rating on Rotten Tomatoes and only 48% with the audience. Plot-wise, it looks at two Catholic schoolgirls who get left behind at their boarding school over the winter break, as all the other girls leave to go home. But it is rumoured that the nuns who look after them are Satanists. Meanwhile, a young woman is picked up by an elderly couple who are driving to the same school, where the girls end up battling a mysterious evil force. This film stars Lizzie Boynton, Keira Shipley, Emma Roberts, and James Remar. So, Lee, to you, first thoughts, what had you heard about this film going in, and is this a first watch for you?
Yeah, absolutely nothing. This has been on my watch list for quite a while, and I picked up as a 99 cents rental a couple of months ago, actually. And I thought, right, that's my opportunity to check this one out. I didn't know anything to do with the plot, didn't know any of the cast. The poster didn't really give anything away. So kind of when I went into it, I was completely kind of blind. And I really enjoyed this one. I think it's a really good atmospheric piece. I think it's got a great female cast, Emma Roberts, Kiernan Shipka, I'm terrible at that, and Lucy Boynton. So I was really happy with those actresses. Lucy Boynton is someone that I've really enjoyed from her performance in Sing Street, and every time she pops up in something, I'm like, oh, that's great, I trust someone saw her in Sing Street and thought she was good enough to hire for their film. So yeah, this was one I enjoyed. It was completely unexpected, and I sometimes say that when you see sort of A24 followed by the DirecTV logo, sometimes you think, oh, is this going to be sort of a bit of a hit or miss film? But I think this one was a real highlight, and definitely one of the best DirecTV films that they did. I just thought it was sort of in sort of a similar vein to The Witch, this strong female characters, bloodshed, satanic sort of imagery. I think this one is a pretty underrated A24 film, and I'm surprised it's not broken out, perhaps.
Yeah, no, I had not heard much about this film going in, and I managed to finally get it on Netflix. It appeared a couple of months ago, so it went straight to top of my list for that. And yeah, no, I was really pleasantly surprised by this one. It's a film which has gone completely under the radar, but I think it's actually a bit of a hidden gem in the A24 catalogue here. It's definitely got similarities with The Witch. I think there's a black figure that sort of hangs around in the background. You know, is it goat shaped? Potentially. It's certainly got some horns, so there's elements of Black Phillip in there. Like you say, I think the casting is great. I'd heard Emma Roberts was in it, and so for the first 20 minutes I thought Lucy Boynton was Emma Roberts, and I thought Emma Roberts looks different. Maybe it's just because she's dyed her hair, and then realised, oh wait, that's not, it's the girl from Sing Street, which again is a hugely underrated film, and if you've never seen Sing Street, please do, because it's just a fantastic, fantastic film. And interestingly, this film came out a couple of years ago, and in terms of witch references, it's actually got Sabrina the Teenage Witch before she became Sabrina the is it Sabrina the Teenage Witch on Netflix, or is it just Sabrina now?
It's Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
It's Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, yes, because they have to slightly distance themselves from the Melissa Joan Hart one, I guess. But I thought she was very good in this as well. I hadn't seen her in anything. I haven't seen any of the new Sabrina, so I thought she was excellent in this. And yeah, no, I thought it was a real great hidden gem, and it's definitely one that I'm going to be recommending. So in terms of, you know, the name of the film, we've got a bit of contention depending whether you're watching it. In the UK, it seems to be marketed as February, because this film takes place at the end of February, and there's a sort of countdown to the final day in February at the end of this sort of holiday. Or they've got, in America, it's called The Black Coat's Daughter. So in terms of the black coat itself, who did you take that to mean? Because I think we've got sort of two options. There's either the sort of the devil character who's trying to seduce one of the girls into becoming like a daughter figure, or is the black coat meaning James Remar's character, who's basically driving to see his daughter at the school?
I kind of wondered as well if there's potentially a third one in there as well, that we have this obsession where like a lot of kind of satanic shit goes down in a boiler room, and I was sort of wondering about, you know, is that sort of like a little kind of a term for people that work sort of next to coal fires and against boilers? They're likely to get kind of all covered in black and kind of suited.
The black lung.
And
pop.
Whether there was
the black lung.
Yeah. Whether there was something that could be taken from that as well. I personally had it perhaps as cat, but I think like you could have it as, you know, it could easily be that, or you know, James Remar as well. I think I like that as well. I prefer that title to February, because I remember I didn't even know about the February thing until I think you said it. We were sat on the couch and you went, oh yeah, February's been added to Netflix, and I didn't have a single clue what you were talking about at first. I was like, okay. And then I discovered it sort of had this UK title, which similar to Laggies, and it had a different name in the UK. I can't remember what it was, and it was just like, oh, why? The Black Coat's Daughter sounds all the more interesting, kind of pulls you in, something sounds a bit different, whereas February just sounds so generic and kind of boring. It just felt like a disappointment.
Yeah, no, I think they could have, unless it says a black coat apparently is a reference to a clergyman, so I guess it's maybe to do with the Catholic school that they're in, but maybe that term didn't really mean much in the UK, so therefore they went with something. But I think they could have maybe come up with something, yeah, like you say, slightly less generic than just February, because it's a bit, it doesn't really mean anything. And technically, I think the film could have been set at any time during the year. So, yeah. In terms of, you know, the horror credentials we've got here, this is something which I didn't realise until after sort of I'm watching the film and sort of Googling and finding out who Osgood Perkins was, and sort of looking through his sort of IMDb things, and it was like, oh, he's got a cool little horror credential there. He apparently played a young Norman Bates in Psycho 2. I thought, oh, that's cool. And then went, wait, hang on, Perkins. No, it couldn't be. And it's like, yes, no, apparently he is the son of Anthony Perkins, who played, most famously, of course, Norman Bates in Psycho. So clearly the man knows his horror, and I thought he did an excellent job on this in terms of sort of setting the mood and also the structure of the film, which I'd like to touch on as well. But did you realise this sort of familial reference before seeing the film? Or?
No, I didn't realise that at all. I only discovered it when I did some Wikipedia research as well. It was a real kind of surprise to discover that. And also that he had a cameo in Star Trek as well, which was pretty cool for this Star Trek.
Yeah, film. I did see that one and thought, oh yeah, I better tell Lee about that one, because yeah, he'll be excited to know. I can't remember. I'd have to rewatch Star Trek to figure out, maybe he's one of the red shirts in the Enterprise who gets blown up at some point, perhaps. But I'll have to check that out. But yeah, no, he's definitely got, now I've seen pictures of him, he's definitely got a resemblance of his father. But I think he's someone that I'm definitely going to keep an eye on to check out some of his other films and stuff, because I think he understands horror and how to deliver it. Because, I mean, you've got this sort of, I think I've talked about it before on other shows and stuff like that, but you've got sort of tension versus suspense, and I think he does both quite well. And sort of tension is where, you know, the audience is in the same boat as the characters, and they know pretty much the same thing as the characters. So I'm thinking of like a great scene like The Thing, where nobody knows who the thing is, not even the audience. So like the blood test scene is a great example of, you're completely on edge because you have no idea who it is. Whereas you think suspense, you know, Hitchcock, the master of suspense, but you've got like Halloween. It's like, well, we all know that Michael Myers is outside and he's hunting down all these people. So it's just figuring out when he's going to strike. And I thought there was a great sort of shift sort of halfway through. And I guess we could talk about it. It's slightly going into spoilers here, but, you know, the narrative structure where you think that the two sort of storylines are happening concurrently, but it turns out that one of them is in the past and one's in the future. What did you make of that sort of twist and reveal? Because I thought it was actually quite well handled and actually worked quite well for this story, whereas in some films you've sort of seen it done and it feels like a cheap trick, but I think it actually kind of worked for what Osgood was trying to do with this film.
Yeah, I really liked it as well, and I think it adds sort of replay value to the film, because I think when I watched this one for the first time, I was sort of, I was like kind of tired. I think it was like a Friday evening, and I was like, right, you know what, I'm going to shove on this iTunes rental. And then I was like, oh wow, they've got this sort of narrative twist. And then sort of when it came time for this episode, I dived back in again last week, and I really enjoyed the kind of seeing that sort of structure, knowing how it was going to go. I thought that was a really clever introduction, and I thought, yeah, I just think it was incredibly well written.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to go into the details of the case, because it's a film which I don't really want to spoil for, only because I expect a lot of people will have not seen it. But we are urging you to check this one out if you can. Like I say, it's on Netflix UK and it's available on iTunes and America. But I really like the way it played out, because like you say, you think you're watching one particular story, but it turns out, and it's all playing, I think it's because it's like you say, it's so well written that it's actually a shock when you realize that what you're seeing is not exactly what you thought it was, and it makes you reevaluate everything that you've seen. And I think it's just really, it's a sign of a really sort of talented writer and director who's able to do that and sort of pull the rug out from under you, but also then keep you wanting to know what happens at the end and not feeling like a cheap trick. And I think, yeah, it sort of really played out well and is incredibly sort of effective in its use of sort of gore, and it doesn't rely on, like, you know, the sort of jump scares and stuff like that. It's a sort of unease and a sort of building of sort of dread and stuff like that, in a similar way to The Witch did. I think, you know, it's easily a sort of companion piece that you could easily watch the two if you're looking for a sort of, you know, a devil seducing, you know, young women into doing his bidding sort of thing. A double bill, and an A24 double bill at that as well. So,
I think there's one thing that works quite well as well. Like, I know you haven't seen the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, but I also think it works really well with that I loved Sabrina the Teenage Witch growing up as a kid. I thought it was one of the funniest shows to watch. I think it was Nickelodeon or something on at the time. And I remembered sort of when they'd cast Kiernan as Sabrina, I'd only sort of known her from Mad Men as one of the young daughters. And I sort of, it was interesting thinking, oh, I wonder how she went from such a different role to ending up in Sabrina. And Sabrina feels very heavily inspired. When you watch it, you think, oh my god, like, this is sort of kind of drawing really from things like The Witch, for example. It's got a bit more kind of humor about it, but you can almost see sort of a connective tissue between something like The Witch and then this film, and then sort of the Wicked Adventures of Sabrina, and then sort of seeing why someone like Kiernan has ended up getting that kind of that main role as sort of Sabrina. I thought she really was excellent. You know, she's awkward, she's definitely creepy. You know, she certainly embodies that kind of a lot of what we kind of get to see sort of with this Sabrina character in this new remake. She's certainly not Melissa Joan Hart, and I think that this film got her that role, and the fact that both of them are on Netflix kind of make it a nice little double bill. If someone enjoys something like Sabrina, and it certainly seems to be popular, there's this film available as well. I think that it certainly adds
to it. Hopefully if you are watching The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina on Netflix, then hopefully February comes up as a, well, if you like this, then you might enjoy this, and hopefully it'll mean that a wider audience get to discover this. But I'm certainly looking forward to exploring more of Oz Perkins' films down the line, but I'm sort of keen maybe not to go into the finer details of this film too much, just to avoid spoiling it for everyone, because I think it's, like you say, it's there's sort of something happens sort of halfway along, and I think it's best discovered on your own, and that way I think people are going to find a real surprise and a real treat in store for them when they watch this one, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's definitely one of these surprise films that I think we've spoken about this a lot, that there's films that we think, oh my God, this is one that I've not heard anyone talking about. It's an A24 film that's gone underneath the radar. And sometimes you get a film like it's The Revenge of the Green Dragons, and then sometimes you get a film like The Black Coat Star, where it's like, oh wow, like this was a real hidden treat, and we can go out and talk to people about an A24 film they might not have seen.
I know, yeah, and it's a shame that Osgood Perkins isn't on Twitter, because he's certainly a filmmaker I think would be really interesting to sort of sit down and be able to talk with at depth about his ideas behind the film and how he came up with his story and stuff like that. So hopefully in the future he'll be another one that we can add to our roster of names who've appeared on the A24 project. But seamlessly segueing into names that have appeared on the A24 project, we're going to tee up a quick interview. And Lee, you were lucky enough to speak to director Ben Wheatley a couple of years ago for the release of Free Fire when he was in Edinburgh. Now, Ben Wheatley likes to go on sort of mini tours on some of his films. He did it with High Rise and he did it with Free Fire, where he goes around some sort of local independent cinemas, does a screening and then does a Q&A. And then the people who ask questions get cool little T-shirts with some of his own sort of drawings as the design on them. So do you want to tee up this quick interview with Ben and tease him with what you've discussed?
All the way back in February or March 2016. This is originally a filibuster interview that we did. And at the time, this was like, we'd done one interview on the podcast, and it was with someone from a Louis Theroux documentary. And I like totally chanced it. I was like, I'd love to have the chance to interview Ben Wheatley. And I found like a contact for like his agent. And it was like, media thing, so fired off an email, never heard anything, and then the day of the screening I got an email back like, if you can make it down to like this hotel for 9 a.m. the next day, you can interview Ben Wheatley. And the joy of my job is I work flexi time, and I was like, I will most definitely be there. So I took along a friend of mine. We went along to interview him, and we checked into this sort of hotel, and we saw Ben Wheatley and is it Sam Riley? So we saw Sam Riley and Ben Wheatley, and they were like, oh yeah, you're here to interview Ben Wheatley and Sam Riley. And we were like, oh, we might be getting Sam Riley here too. And I was like, yes, we are definitely here to interview both of them. So we got taken down to the hotel room where we'd meet Ben Wheatley. Fortunately, Sam Riley couldn't make it. He was rushing late. Considering we were interviewing them at like 9 o'clock, and their train to Newcastle was 9:45 for the next leg of the tour. So we had like a 50-minute conversation where we chatted about Free Fire, and we kind of squeezed in some chat as well about some of his other films like Kill List, Field in England, just kind of tried to cram in as many things as we could discuss in 50 minutes as possible. And this was the first time we ever got the chance to interview Ben Wheatley, but it was a real treat, and it was like one of the first like proper interviews we got to do. So I always had it in the sort of up our sleeve that when we eventually hit this episode, that we could wheel out this Ben Wheatley interview again for a second time.
You fill up my senses.
So we're joined by Ben Wheatley in a glamorous hotel room. Thank you so much for coming along today. We went to see Free Fire last night and loved it. We've been doing Boston accents all morning on the walk down to the
Good
hotel.
Good luck with that, yeah.
I think it was varying degrees of success, but the film stuck in our head, the John Denver song stuck in our head.
Yeah, it was a great screening at the Cameo last night.
Yeah,
it was great fun, yeah.
And how's the tour been so far? What's been kind of the response?
Yeah, like that, pretty much. It's really interesting after doing the High Rise tour was really cool, uh-huh. But everyone was very, meditative and thoughtful at the end of those screenings, where these screens, everyone's like, rah, you know. And it's lovely touring around with a film that's kind of, that's really chiming with the audience, you know. It's great.
Yeah, like we were at the high rise tour and it was really good, and like free t-shirts are always a nice incentive at the end.
Exactly, you know, it is bribery and corruption at its worst, but it does work. And it's basically for that thing of just taking the stuffiness out of the Q&A situation, uh-huh. You know. And I think if people, you know, and they should be given something for, because it's hard, you know, to think up a question and to ask it in a big room full of people, uh-huh. You know, and it's nice to come away with something. It's almost like the kind of mixing of the blurring of the line between a gig and going to a film, you know, to have a kind of,
yeah, because they don't seem to do these kind of big tours anymore. It's not like it's just London and some other kind of town in England. It's like all through Scotland, Inverness, all these kind of places seem to get recognised.
I mean, I really made an effort to, you know, it's Inverness and Truro, you know, so we've gone from the top to the bottom, pretty much. Not no disrespect to Shetland, though, now that's another, that's even further north. But I mean, I've really enjoyed it, you know. And I when I looked at where we went for High Rise, I thought I really want to see. I mean, I know we'd neglected like the kind of the East Coast a bit, and we'd certainly neglected the South West. So we definitely wanted to get in there. And then, yeah, there's one more date in Scotland, a couple more dates in Ireland than we did last time.
Brilliant. Like, one thing we were thinking was like, this is like Brie Larson's first like film since she's done like the Room and won the Oscar. Like, how did you kind of incentivize her to like come on board and make this film? Like, she's probably the choice of all these movies and all these directors, and you're like, come join us. What was kind of your
it's timing is everything, and I come out of this looking like a spider mastermind because I get her, you know, she does it's the first film after the Oscar. But the reality of it was that Room wasn't even finished when she shot Free Fire.
Oh, really?
So, because it was a year or so ago. So, yeah, there was no Oscar.
Whereas now you've got an Oscar-winning actress in your film. It's the perfect selling point.
No, it's cool, you know. And it was really amazing watching that journey of, like, go, you know, we'd heard Room was good, and then Room's really good, and then, oh my God, Room! And then, and she's going to get nominated for an Oscar. Is she? Or, you know, and suddenly she was, you know.
Brilliant. And has that made like a difference to kind of promoting the film? Has it given it kind of a special edge?
Not especially, no. I mean, I think it's it depends where you are. You know, in the UK, the people, you know, it's Cillian Murphy and Michael Smiley, uh-huh. and Sam Riley are kind of more important in terms of the local audience, you know, because they're faces that everybody knows and loves. You know, and it's great that Sam's all over the front of the Radio Times this last week for SSGB, and then Peaky Blinders has got a massive audience, you know. So, and people just love Michael Smiley anyway. Yeah. So
that, they were the stars of the show as well last night. I think every line they came out with just like absolutely killed it.
Yeah. So that's but then in America it's a different story, you know. Then it's Brie and Army come into their own a bit more and kind of bring a different audience. Yeah.
What was it like working with such like an international cast? It wasn't just the usual kind of British ensemble. It seemed to be everyone from all around the world. And Austria.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was cool. I mean, it was lovely working with Brie and with Army, you know. But to be honest, you know, the experience of it's always similar, and it's not changed really since Down Terrace, even on High Rise when it was like with, you know, Jeremy Irons and Tom Hiddleston and people like that, and Luke Evans and Sienna Miller. It's all once you get in front of the camera, it's the same thing. There's just other, you know, bigger trailers and stuff in the background.
We had a couple of questions as well then from kind of our listeners, and they wanted to pose them to you. Obviously you did some work on Doctor Who as well. What was that like working on TV as opposed to kind of film, and would you maybe make a television series?
Well, TV, it depends what show you're doing and how it's put together, but TV tends to be writer and producer led. So as a director, you're kind of a little bit further down the pecking order in terms of what you can do. So and certainly on a show like Doctor Who, it's like, you know, you're going in with a lot of sets of controls, rightly so. So the show remains similar and true to its roots. So I could go in there and do whatever I wanted. I kind of had to do what I was told to a degree, or do it within the spirit of Doctor Who. Otherwise, they would have come and knocked on my door and asked me to stop.
Yeah.
But I did it because I loved the show, you know. So that was super cool. But in terms of doing thing myself, I'm not sure. There's loads of offers been bouncing around for ages. But the worry I have about it is that it just takes me out of the film game for so long. And it's this weird situation of, like, you know, if you make a pilot and it's successful, then you have to keep doing it, and you could be on that ride for, like, you know, this is the weird pressure of, you know, of the threat of success. You know, if you do it, you could be on it for 6 years or something. Yeah. I don't know if I'm that excited about that, but I do. You know, I watch a ton of telly, so it's kind of interesting.
Like, you seem to be like the equivalent of like the indie Star Wars, that you seem to have a movie out every single year to look forward to.
Yeah. Not this year though, sadly.
Are you taking a wee break?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, when I came here with High Rise, we'd already shot Free Fire. So to have another film out next year, it would already have to be done, and it's not.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a couple of years now, I think.
Excellent. Like, I always think back to like Field in England. It felt like a big experiment at the time, like the simultaneous release.
Mm.
Do you think, like, looking back, that was a success, or is that a model that could be replicated again in the future for some of your other films?
I think that if you make a really commercial film, then maybe that could work to make money. But for Field in England, it was a success in terms of that no one would have ever seen that film if we hadn't have done it like that. It would have gone out to like 5 cinemas and disappeared, you know. Certainly would never have made it up to Scotland, I don't think. But because, and the plan was to use the publicity of the simultaneous release and it being on TV to kind of slingshot it around, and it got some crazy, you know, there was stuff on Radio 3 and, you know, and national news about the release of it, which was bizarre at the time. And so it got a much bigger release. And when it was over that weekend, it got seen by about 1 million people, which is, that's for me, that's it. That's the success. But in terms of making a living wage off of making films, it was not much of a success, you know. So I think I had to, you know, that year Amy and I could hardly earned any money at all, and had to, you know, had to subsidize it with doing ads and stuff. So I don't know. I mean, I think if it had been a really bright, chirpy rom-com rather than a black and white kind of psychedelic misery fest about the English Civil War, then maybe it would have worked better. Yeah, you
know? I've still got my beer that was released at the time and
stuff.
Me
too,
it's on my book, my bookcase, so it keeps me company. Kill List was like one of my favourite films of the past few years. Like, I saw it opening weekend, I've never felt more uncomfortable watching a film. Do people still bother you these days, like asking you about that ending, or, you know, what's been kind of the film that you're looking back that had the most kind of long term impact?
I think that people really do love Kill List, and it seems to be over the years that, you know, people are obsessed by it to a degree, which is great for me. I'm really happy about that. But I think each of the films has been very different from the last. They all have their own sets of fans, and they all have the same, you know, there's a pattern, which is, you know, he hasn't made a good film since film X, which is usually their favourite one. So there's still like a hardcore of people who think I haven't got any better since Down Terrace, you know.
Yeah.
But then some people, their favourite film is Field, or the favourite film is Sightseers, you know. So I'm happy with that as well. It's great that people care, you know.
What was it like kind of going from you and your wife working on High Rise, adapting one of the most difficult books ever to adapt? Would you ever want to write a book, write an adapted screenplay again, or is it just strictly your own stuff, your own material that makes you passionate?
Well, I think it just comes with different sets of pressures, you know. Like an adapted screenplay, you're not just writing it for yourself, you've got a responsibility to all the people that read the book, you know, and they all have come with an opinion. And it's really hard to crack through that kind of thing of people going, oh, the book's better than the film. Well, the book's different from the film. It always is with every book, you know. And it's just easier if you just please yourself with your own stuff, because you've got there's no backstop of people, you know, who can come from a higher authority going, but the book. But it doesn't. Well, I mean, I'm working on adapting the novel of Wages of Fear, so that's coming, but that's much more straight ahead.
Yeah. When can people kind of expect Wages of Fear?
I don't know. I mean, I think we're hopefully shooting it this year, but we'll see.
Yeah.
It's, you know, as usual, it's kind of, as soon as I say it on record, it probably won't happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll embargo this for like until the new
news 5 years. Time,
exactly. Yeah. Thank you so much for today and everything and coming along. Like, you've obviously got to head off now, so thank you so much for coming along.
Oh,
today.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Cool. Yeah. Well, that's thanks again, Lee, for a fantastic interview with Ben. And I was lucky enough to meet Ben at the Glasgow Film Festival, I think the year after that, and he'd come up for, he didn't have a film, he always likes coming up with a film. Like the previous 2 years, he'd done High Rises and then Free Fire at the Glasgow Film Festival, and I think I was at the screening of Free Fire, but then he wasn't there because he was over doing the Q&A in Edinburgh for that one. And so he came up and just to do a Q&A, just because he likes the festival, likes to chat. And so one question I did get to ask him, and it's one that is pertinent to Free Fire. And I asked him how he felt about kickstarting the John Denver cinematic revival of 2017 that would also see Alien Covenant, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul, Okja, Logan Lucky, Kingsman, The Golden Circle, that would all use Annie's song or Take Me Home, Country Road in the films. And he didn't realise that he was actually the first film of that year to actually do it, but he was proud that he managed to kick off everyone's... Do you remember that year being very John Denver heavy in the cinema?
Yeah, most definitely. When I rewatched this film the other day, I really was taken back to that bizarre year. I remember just watching films like, as you mentioned, Logan Lucky, and then they start singing. I was like, what the hell is going on with this year? How did this come to be? I was definitely one of those weird quirks. It was the ants in Bugs Life of that year.
Yeah, I know. It's like, because all these films, you know, you're talking about big Hollywood productions like Alien Covenant and Kingsman or whatever, they would have all been filmed at various different times, but it just so happened that within a period of about 4 to 5 months, they all were released at the same time and all managed to feature the exact same song. So, yeah, the John Denver royalty company would have been rubbing their hands at glee, I'm sure, at that time. And so, yeah, we're talking, of course, about Free Fire, which featured it. And the Free Fire, written and directed by Ben Wheatley, and it's set in Boston in 1978, where an arms deal in a deserted warehouse between two gangs turns into a shootout in a game of survival, starring Oscar winner Brie Larson. She'd just won the Oscar by the time that film came out, so it certainly helped with the marketing. Also stars Armie Hammer, Charlton Copley, Cillian Murphy, Michael Smiley, and Jack Rayner. And so, Lee, I take it your first screening of Free Fire was probably just before meeting Ben, was it?
Yeah, we caught the film the night before, and yeah, I was really excited for this one. I think it had like a hell of a cast, and it was interesting, the idea of Ben Wheatley going to America, using sort of American actors, that when you think of all his films to this point, they very much felt like British kitchen sink, you know, dramas with British names, British unknowns. And then sort of this was like, oh, people are starting to kind of take notice of Ben Wheatley here and kind of get behind him. I mean, you know, even sort of look at the involvement, I think Martin Scorsese was involved in this and sort of a production side as well. Like it felt like, oh wow, this guy's gonna, he's not just like a hidden secret between people like me and you anymore that kind of maybe catch these films. And it was really interesting to see the names that he managed to attract and get involved, and it felt like actors that were quite well known to us, perhaps the Noah Taylors, Sam Riley's from sort of British films to an extent, and then sort of a combination of maybe up and coming American actors that were just cast just before they sort of really took off, you know, your Armie Hammers, your Brie Larson's, and you know, Jack Rayner as well, you know, he had an appearance here. I was like, man, it's another Sing Street talent that's been found here, and who would eventually go on to play a bit of a prominent role in Midsommar as well. So yeah, it was a really interesting cast, and great to see sort of Ben Wheatley's rise.
Yeah, no, I was really excited for this one. You know, it was announced, and essentially the plot was, it's just one massive gunfight in a warehouse, and it's like, when you say that, it's like, how can that, that's not really a film, how can they sustain the momentum of that? But then, you know, in 2015 we had Mad Max Fury Road, which is essentially a car chase over 90 minutes, 2 hours, but it, when it is done as well as Mad Max, is you don't care, you want to see more of it. And I think this really is the sort of the Mad Max Fury Road of gunfights. It's like, I think it's really well written, and Ben Wheatley sort of, it is very good at establishing character and sort of backstory very, very quickly, in sort of setting up rivalries between characters and motivations and stuff like that. So like within 20 minutes when, you know, the first bullet is fired and it all kicks off, it's like, you know, how you've got different sort of subplots and sort of storylines which you know are going to follow through. And he always does a great job of checking in and making sure everyone knows where everyone is at any particular time in terms of the location of the warehouse. And I think it's just really effective storytelling, and also he's really sort of developing as an action director as well, because I think some of the gunfights and stuff are very well staged as well.
Yeah, I really, the one thing I've enjoyed about this film, and sort of on repeat viewings as well, is I enjoy action, but I've never been a huge like action kind of guy. Like, I like when my action is like small bursts where it just explodes into life. You know, I'm thinking of something like the Raid, for example. When I watched this film, for example, I enjoyed the action, but what I really loved was the action of the patter between all the kind of characters. I thought they all kind of really bounced off each other a lot, and when they sort of moved away from, you know, when they kind of got into the scenes of the shootouts, I was less interested than when they were all sort of together, when you have someone like Charlotte Copley's character, Vernon. I thought everything he said just had me amused, and I liked sort of how he kind of came off against sort of Arnie Hammer's character, Cillian Murphy's character. I just thought I really loved that side of it more than the action sequence. And when it sort of, after the first sort of few minutes of the action sequence, it was like, oh yeah, this is really cool, I just sort of began to lose interest in it a little bit. But whenever they were back together again talking, I was like, yep, that's me back in. So kind of when I'm watching this film, I always kind of felt like I was just sort of dipping in and out of it to an extent.
Yeah, so you prefer rapid fire dialogue to rapid fire shootouts.
Exactly that.
Yeah, I mean the dialogue is great. You know, Charlotte Copley is fantastic. I think this is a sort of, you know, Vernon, you know, Vernon Byrne, baby, Vernon Byrne. And this is actually the film that probably turned me around on Armie Hammer. You know, I thought he was great in Social Network to the point that I thought he actually had a twin. I didn't realize it was digital. But then he kind of lost me sort of in the sort of like Lone Ranger period and whatever. But this was the sort of film that sort of turned me around. I was really sort of taken by him in this. I thought he was great, quite smarmy, but also quite charming and quite cool. And, you know, he's just gone on to bigger and better things with like sort of Call Me By Your Name and stuff like that. But I think, you know, Michael Smiley, you know, Tires from Space, he's always going to be Tires from Space for me. I think it's great whenever he pops up and stuff. He was great in Kill List by Ben Wheatley. And I think he was great in this as well. And, you know, the little rivalries of him and sort of Armie Hammer, sort of with them each sort of going at each other. You've got sort of Cillian Murphy and Charlotte Copley have got a thing. Jack Rayner and Sam Riley, everyone's got like an enemy on the other side. And, you know, at some point that they're going to have to get a sort of final face off. So I thought that was great. And it was nice that Brie Larson was there to try and sort of diffuse the situation, but then she ends up just going, oh, well, boys will be boys, and then sort of gets involved in the action as well. So I thought that was good and sort of, yeah, sort of teeing her up as you could see that there's definitely something in her in terms of her sort of boldness and stuff like that, that you could see why she'd be a great choice for Captain Marvel, I think, at that point as well.
Yeah, I think this is definitely one of her kind of lovely roles. And I just like the, what's her line where it's like, oh, we can't all be good girls as well. I just thought like she delivered that with such a plume. And I just think this is an enjoyable film for the characters. And I would love to have spent more time perhaps with the characters I just wish it had sort of been distilled down to that just a little bit more. But, you know, maybe those sort of short, sharp bursts of kind of the witty dialogue would have been lost if this was more 90 minutes of people interacting and having patter off each other. It might have been difficult to keep that up.
Yeah, no, I think I can see what you say. I mean, it might have been something that might have maybe worked as like a fun sort of mini series with sort of exploring a, because I mean, there's almost an entire movie to be made out of The Night Before, almost, with an incident involving Jack Rayner and Sam Riley's character, which is the thing that is the match that sort of sparks this whole thing off into the gunfight. So, you know, you could have almost had a prequel to Free Fire, which shows everyone sort of enjoying a night out in Boston before the gunfight and stuff like that, and maybe even afterwards, because it certainly, you don't get definitive closure at the end of this film either. You know, it's still slightly up in the air as to what happens and stuff like that. So, you know, there's maybe room to move on in the future, but I think it's certainly a one-off in terms of Ben Wheatley. You know, he's currently doing he's done a Rebecca adaptation for Netflix. He's always been someone who's been mentioned as around the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but something it's never happened. I know Marvel Zombies was mentioned at some point, which is, I think, maybe going to be sort of one of the What If sort of animated series episodes or something like that. But I mean, what would you want to see, sort of, what do you want from Ben Wheatley going forward? Because, you know, he's certainly not for everyone. We do have someone on the Nerd Party who just is not a Ben Wheatley fan, even when we keep trying to get just to watch High Rise. He's just never going to do it, but
Do you know? Oh, he watched High Rise.
Oh, did he?
He just absolutely despised it and has held against me ever since.
Ever since, all right. So yeah, he's been put off Ben Wheatley for life because of that. Yeah, no, that's it. But yeah, no, maybe, do you think if he did get into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it would make Tristan have to watch another one of his films?
Possibly. I really enjoyed Happy New Year, Colin Burstead, that was out last year. Got shown at London Film Festival, and then it was like a New Year's BBC release here in the UK, and I think it had a small kind of tour as well. I'm interested to see Rebecca, and I think it was like an Adam Buxton podcast where I can't remember the name of the actor. I think it was like Frank Skinner or someone, Badil, I can't remember who it was, basically like mentioned, oh yeah, like Ben Wheatley, he's going to be doing one of these Marvel films, and it sort of leaked from there. I was surprised when they sort of announced the kind of recent slate of Marvel movies that his name didn't pop up, but I guess we could find out at some point. But yeah, I really like Ben Wheatley as a director. I think he's a fantastic writer. I think he has a great eye for putting a great film together, great dialogue. He's definitely one of my kind of go-to directors. Whenever something gets announced, always feels like an event for me, and one I really enjoy. I think he things like that, tours that he does, really helps build a special connection with fans. And even like doing that interview with us, like, he didn't have to do that, you know, he had probably better things to do at 9 o'clock in the morning, but he took the time, and it kind of shows the class of a man that he would take the time to chat with like a small kind of independent outlet like ours.
Yeah, no, he's a great guy. I mean, after he spent about half an hour chatting with fans after the Q&A that he did in Glasgow, so he's got a lot of time for them. You know, his films get fairly small releases, but he knows that he does have a fan base out there, and it's definitely, you know, growing, and, you know, he definitely has a lot of time for the people who do watch his films. And, you know, this is definitely a recommendation from us. I think it's one, like you say, it's got of Scorsese's name on it, which helps sort of sell it in America. I don't think it was a huge hit, but I think it's got a bit of a cult following. It's definitely worth watching. I mean, sort of Tarantino fans, I think, would definitely love this film. It's, like you say, it's got rapid fire, very witty dialogue on top of, you know, great action. It's basically like an extrapolation of the sort of Mexican standoff in Reservoir Dogs, if, you know, played out over sort of 90 minutes. Again, this is another film which I think is about 90-100 minutes. You know, we've been going through a great run of A24 films at the moment, which have been around about that sort of sweet spot that, you know, is not too long and not too short as well. So we're on a good run at the moment, and long may it continue in terms of the quality of the films we're watching, I think.
Definitely.
Absolutely. So next week we're going to be back with Lee. You've got another great interview, another bonus star for us, and you're going to be talking to Greg Sestero from The Disaster Artist and, of course, The Room. Do you want to give us a quick tease about what we might expect from that one?
Yeah, I had like the biggest smile on my face throughout. Like, Greg has such an amazing positivity, and if this doesn't get you hooked in, he does the absolute best Tommy Wiseau impression that you could ever hear. And I'm really excited to share this interview. This was one that I couldn't believe it when he agreed to it. I couldn't believe it when he actually turned up to do it. And then throughout, I was just sitting on the other end of a FaceTime call, just like beaming from ear to ear. I am really excited to share this one. I recorded this one about a month ago, so it feels like it's been a long time coming. This has been the one I would love to just drop out straight away, but scheduling's got to be scheduled. So yeah, hopefully people will enjoy this one.
Absolutely. So I've listened to it, and it's fantastic. So you're really all going to enjoy it. And it's basically Lee and Greg just talking about their sex lives for 2 hours. Oh, hi, Mark. So that's next week, and then we'll be back in 2 weeks' time for another episode of the General A24 Project. And we're going to be looking at The Lovers and The Exception. And if anyone ever believes it, you know, typecasting is not a thing, The Exception will star Christopher Plummer as a Nazi. So, you know, we've had two films with Nazi dogs, and this will be our second film with Christopher Plummer as a Nazi. So, you know, that's always good. So I look forward to chatting with you those ones then. But we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.